This is the Comics Alternative, episode 205. Reviews of Angel Catbird, volume 1, Ever After, number 1, and Glitter Bomb, number 1. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Comics Alternative. I'm Derek.
And I'm Andy, and we're two guys with PhDs talking about comics.
And on this week's episode, Andy and I are going to look at three recent comics. We're going to begin with Angel Catbird, written by Margaret Atwood with art by Johnny Christmas. After that, we're going to look at two number one issues. First, Ever After, by David Justice, Matthew Sturges, and art by Travis Moore. Then we're going to wrap up with Jim Zub and Jabril Morissette-Fonn's Glitter Bomb. But before we get to those discussions, we want to let all of you guys know that this episode of the Comics Alternative is brought to you by the great folks at Discount Comic Book Service. Go to their website, dcbservice.com, for all of your comics pre-ordering needs. There, you're going to find all DC, Marvel, Image, and Dark Horse titles at 40% off of the cover price if you pre-order. For all of the other publishers, you'll find that those discounts are 20 to 35% off of the cover price. And every single month, including September, you're going to find some unbelievable specials. Sometimes those specials will go up to 45% off the cover price, sometimes 50% off cover, but it's not unusual to find discounts that go higher than that.
That's right. And since we're talking about Angel Catbird, you can actually find that on DCB Service this month for 40% off. So that's $8.99. And then the third issues of Ever After and Glitter Bomb are also available for 40% off. So you can check those out.
That's right. You can always count on great prices at Discount Comic Book Service. Head over to their website, dcbservice.com. They'll take care of all of your comics pre-ordering needs. And after you do get your comics there, please be sure to send them an email and tell them that the two guys with PhDs sent you.
That's right.
Well, Andy, we have a good number of things to discuss this week, but before we get into a discussion of the comics, I want to let everyone know that they can now find Comics Alternative on yet another media outlet, and this is iHeartRadio.
That's great. So we're mastering all media at this point.
Yeah, or at least media where you can find podcasts. So that's something very recent. I just got notification or confirmation over the past week that we were accepted into iHeartRadio. And if you wanted to see our page on iHeartRadio, it's like www.iHeart.com/show/263-comics-alternative. But just go to iHeartRadio, iHeart.com, and do a search for Comics Alternative, and you'll find us easily enough.
That's great.
Yeah. So you can find us there, in addition to the other places that you can find us, like, you know, TuneIn and all that. Now, over the summer, we also became available on a couple of other outlets. I think they're kind of minor, but I don't know if we've announced this. We are on Player FM, so if people use Player FM, they can find Comics Alternative there. We also have been more consistently on SoundCloud, and I know there are a lot of SoundCloud users out there. Now, here's the issue with SoundCloud. We only have a free account because we really, I don't think we can justify buying an account where we have a lot of storage space because we don't need it. You know, we use Libsyn as a provider. So we only have so many minutes of playtime that we can store at one time. And that's no more than two episodes. Depending on the size of the episode, how long it runs, sometimes that could be just one episode that's available, sometimes two. But if people listen to SoundCloud, they can probably catch our most up-to-date episodes that way. But the big news I wanted to announce to everyone this week is iHeartRadio.
That's great. And, you know, I hope someday we maybe get involved with whatever the big iHeartRadio festival is, so we can, you know, be on stage with We could do our podcast alongside like Justin Timberlake or something.
Yeah. And then, you know, who knows, maybe eventually we'll get to the big time and we'll be discovered by National Public Radio and they'll ask us to, in essence, to be the Car Talks of comics discussions.
Yeah, that could work. You know, we are white middle class guys with glasses, so we are definitely right in the NPR demographic.
That's right.
And middle age, I guess, too.
Yeah. So if anybody listening to this works for NPR, you know, you can find our contact information easily enough at comicsalternative.com.
Yeah, and now that I just insulted NPR, they're gonna clamor for that. Or maybe they will. Maybe they'll show they're bigger than that.
So you want to get into a discussion of this week's titles?
Yeah, let's do it.
And we're going to begin with Angel Cat Bird, written by Margaret Atwood with art by Johnny Christmas. And this is notable for a number of reasons. But I think first and foremost, Margaret Atwood, the Canadian novelist, is the writer of this.
That's right. You know, in Margaret Atwood's work, which I've read a lot of. I wouldn't necessarily say I've read everything Margaret Atwood's done, but one of the things I've always appreciated about her work is that it kind of defies genre expectations in a lot of ways. You know, she's a literary author, but she will do, you know, things that are like science fiction. She'll do historical novels and other things too. And plus she is a kind of lifelong comics fan as well. So this seems to be, you know, of kind of literary writers who could do a graphic novel. She seems to be one that that would be entirely capable of that.
Mm-hmm. And I think you're much more familiar with her work than I am. I mean, I know her by Surfacing and The Handmaid's Tale. But other than that, the only thing I know about her work or her, I guess, things related to her work is she's a winner of the Booker Prize.
Yeah, that's true too. And I don't know how, if there are other Booker Prize winners who have written comic books.
I don't know of any. And even if there are, this is the only Booker Prize winner we have discussed on the podcast.
That's true.
Yeah.
With Angel Cat Bird, at the beginning of the book, there's a kind of lengthy introduction that Atwood writes to kind of explain the background of this book for her, how she came to do it. But also one of the things that I think is probably important for readers going into this is the message she wants to convey with this story, which is that to kind of warn people who have cats as pets, and I'm one of these people, to keep their cats indoors. Mm-hmm. And two of the big reasons for that she gives is that domestic cats themselves are responsible for the death of a lot of birds, and that domestic cats that go outside have a higher risk of getting killed, of course, in accidents and so on. And this is something I know I'm personally very, very self-conscious of. In fact, the other night I went out to get the mail late at night, and I walked out the front door and I was taking out the garbage. So I was carrying a garbage bag and I opened the front door and one of my cats dashed out the front door. Luckily I screamed at her and she came back in.
Wow. Like, a cat that listens.
Immediately, but the split second that she was out the door and on the front steps, a lot of things flashed in front of my eyes, and flashed in my brain, I guess, and one of them was Angel Catbird. It's like, oh no, now I know these statistics now about cats getting outside and having terrible things happen to them. Anyway, so I bring that up because bring up the the kind of message that Atwood wants to get across, because that was one of the things I wasn't anticipating when I first, when I read this book, that the narrative would be interrupted at points by facts and statistical information about cats and birds in Canada, the US, and the UK.
Yeah, I didn't expect that either, although she does set this up in that introduction you mentioned, and it does so in an effective way in that it's no surprise when you get to, for instance, I think the first one I'm looking at now, the first instance of this is on page 17, and we get, you know, some facts about, and here, this one I'm looking at is, there lies danger. Outdoor cats live a fraction of the lifespan of indoor cats. And then there's more to that. And she even gives a URL to a website where you can go and look up more of those statistics. And I kind of like that. I mean, I have no problem with these kind of factoids popping up. It's almost like pop-up video on VH1 every now and again in the comic. And I think it works really well. And again, much of my feelings of this comes from her introduction, which, as you pointed out, is rather lengthy, but it goes a long way and effectively to set up why she's doing what she's doing. And it also gives some background as to her relationship with comics, because, you know, over the past several years, we've seen a number of people in the entertainment industry that have nothing to do with comics, but who try their hand at comics to greater or lesser degrees of success. And so here, I mean, she's not the first, I guess, traditional novelist or literary novelist, however you want to define that, to do this. But I remember when I saw this solicited, I thought, huh, okay, that's interesting. I wouldn't have thought that Margaret Atwood would do this. But in her introduction, when she gives a little background about her own history with comics growing up, all of this started to make more sense.
Right, right. And I kind of lump this in with the trend that we're seeing more specifically with writers like, you know, William Gibson doing Archangel,
right,
or Chuck Palahniuk doing Fight Club 2, which is also a Dark Horse book. And then I guess maybe Michael Chabon doing various things, including contributing to Casanova right now.
Jonathan Lethem.
And Jonathan Lethem is a kind of, leader in this, because he did that a while ago, right?
Right. Yeah.
Did Omega and stuff. So yeah. So it's not unprecedented, but it also seems to be, even within the last year or so, something that is happening more and more. Now, what I was worried about when seeing this solicit was that maybe this would just be a situation in which she was the, she came up with an idea that somebody else then wrote. But she is listed as the sole author of this book, sole writer, though she does talk in her introduction about collaborating with Hope Nicholson in particular, who is listed in the editorial credits as project advisor. So I'm not sure exactly how much Hope Nicholson did as far as collaborating with Margaret Atwood, but she does give her a lot of credit in that introduction.
Right. Now, this is the first in, I guess, what's going to be a series. I don't know how many there are going to be. Have they announced it?
I don't know.
Angel Cat Birds?
I was wondering that myself. I don't know.
I know that I've seen number 2 listed on Amazon for sometime early next year. So there are going to be at least 2 of these. I mean, I wouldn't think that this is something that would be ongoing, or at least something that would last past 3 or 4 installments. This is coming out as a hardbound book. And we have, I think, a total of 72 pages of story. I mean, there are more pages to that in the book, but we have this lengthy introduction at the very beginning, and then at the end we have some pinup art by a variety of different artists, and then some sketch art from Christmas. So, I mean, it's a heftier volume than just 72 pages, but that's how much story we have. And I think that the amount of story we get in this first book is substantial. I mean, I think that it begins and ends in an appropriate place. I felt that I got a lot of story for this first issue, at least. Did you feel the same?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And basically what we're getting here is the origin story right away of the Angel Catbird character, who is I'm guessing his job is kind of, I guess, a geneticist or something.
Yeah.
For that effect.
I guess something like that, yeah.
And his name's Strig Philetus, which is a fun name to say.
Yeah.
And he is working on some kind of formula that a previous scientist at this company called Muroid Incorporated had been working on. And Muroid is headed up by Dr. Muroid, who is a strange guy who has as his constant companions a bunch of rats, one of which has a video camera strapped to its head. And Strig, on his, I guess, his first day of work, meets Kate Leone, a coworker who he is immediately attracted to.
Mm-hmm.
And so we get the origin story, basically. And it's a pretty – I mean, I think one of the things that's going on in this book is that Atwood is working with some pretty standard superhero conventions,
right.
Some of which that go back to the golden age, you know. Mm-hmm. So this mysterious – formula that Strig is working on, he, of course, accidentally gets it spilled on him, which is what always happens when you're a scientist in a comic book. And it happens also spill on his cat and a bird, and it causes him kind of genetically to take on the characteristics of both of these animals.
Right. Now, I want to talk further about how Atwood plays in the sandbox of Golden Age and Silver Age comics.
Yeah, yeah.
But in this origin story, since you set it up, basically what happens is that Stig has a cat, a pet cat named Ding. That's a shortened uh-huh. name. And so Ding gets outside, runs outside when he opens the door, runs out into the street where there is, I think it's a rat. And then right as Ding approaches the rat, this bird is swooping down to also get the rat. And then Strig runs out to save his cat, gets hit by a car, and he has the formula in his hands, of course.
Mm-hmm.
We learn that the person who's driving the car is actually this Dr. Muroid.
Mm-hmm.
Ratman, we can call him. and this is no giveaway, right? This is not a spoiler, because
right.
we learn this in the opening pages. And we immediately learn that Muroid actually set this up. It was one of his rats that worked with him to get Strig and his cat out there. He hit him because Strig reported that he thinks he has the formula now, so Muroid no longer has any use for him. Well, mm-hmm. after Strig gets hit, you know, he seems to be dead, but, you know, maybe just temporarily unconscious. And the formula spills on him. Then he turns into this human cat bird thing that we know of as Angel Catbird.
Right. And as this story progresses, we also find out that these kind of animal human hybrids exist in this world, outside of the formula that Strig has completed here, that Dr. Muroid is one, that Kate Leone is one as well. And so a lot of the kind of fun stuff that for me that happens in this issue is when Strig starts to exhibit, even in his human form, cat-like characteristics, and part of that is this kind of uncontrollable attraction that he has for Kate Leone, and that she reciprocates as well.
Right, because when he first meets Kate, his first day of work, this is before the accident, right, and he's turned into this hybrid form, he's attracted to Kate, but it's not obvious. But
right.
then once he has this accident, he goes back to work, he starts to sense her in a completely different way to where he's turned on by her, almost as if she were wearing the catnip, right? He wants to consume her, it seems. And so this accident not only gives him special abilities, you know, the ability to fly, to turn into a cat, or a cat-bird hybrid, but also it heightens his senses in a way that he doesn't have as a human. So this is his introduction or his way into this underworld, right? Mm-hmm. This world that exists, that he didn't know existed before, where there are these hybrid creatures, most of which we see in this first issue are cat-human hybrids. But we also get a little glimpse into other kind of hybrids that I'm assuming we'll learn more in the next one or two volumes.
Right. Yeah, I'm guessing, for example, that Count Catula, who is a human-cat-bat hybrid, is going to have a bigger role. He already has a pretty significant role here as well.
Right. And in the back where the sketches are, there are a number of characters that we have not even been introduced to yet. Like one is an octopus hybrid. What the hell's up with that? But I guess we'll see them later.
That character is in the background in the scene where Angel Catbird goes to the catastrophe.
Oh yeah, that club.
Club that all these hybrids hang out at. And then there are certain rules about these hybrids. Like some tend towards humans more, and so their kind of natural or resting state will be as a human, whereas others tend towards the animal side, so their natural state would be as, in most cases that we see, cats.
Right.
Among other things. So there's a lot of different rules. But I think that one of the other things to mention to anybody coming into this book is that I think it's useful to read it in the spirit of a golden or silver age comic. In addition to having the kind of wacky science and mad scientist villain and so on that you would get in those things, it also tonally feels like an older comic.
Yes.
There's a kind of goofiness to the way the characters speak to each other. Atwood relies a lot on thought balloons, which we don't get in contemporary comics all that much anymore. Mm-hmm. And so again, there's a lot of that stuff. And for me, it was a lot of fun in that way to get this kind of retro feel to this comic.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned the thought balloons, because you're right. That, to me, is a giveaway that we're not in Kansas anymore, at least the Kansas that we've come to recognize as contemporary comics. And, you know, I have to tell you, I wasn't prepared for this tone when I picked it up. And I didn't even get that out of the introduction. You know, I said earlier that one of the things that Atwood does in her intro is to set up what to expect, even with the little, you know, information bits on some of the pages. So she set that up well. And then I start getting into this. And, you know, I guess I should have sensed this from some of the character names that she was mentioning in that introduction, like Count Catula. Now, I mean, I remember thinking, what? Did I just read Count Chocula? No, Catula. So I said, might this be some kind of play on the breakfast cereal? What's going on here? It's strange. And then I read this the first time, and I didn't know exactly how to take it. I thought, I'm not sure if I'm clear on Atwood's tone to her subject matter, or her tone, which her attitude toward this kind of comic. Is she paying tribute to the old golden silver age comics? Is she being slightly ironic? But I have to tell you, I didn't sense any irony here.
No.
And then another thing I wondered was, who is the audience for this? Because on the one hand, it strikes me that someone could pick this up and think, okay, this is kind of hokey. This is something that kids would like. But you know, the kind of people who are reading mainstream comics wouldn't get into this hokiness. At least not ironically. So I have to think that Atwood is playing around here with the history of the genre. At the same time, she's kind of paying homage to the kind of comics that she grew up with, as she tells us in the introduction. But I just wasn't ready for that kind of unusual tone.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that I was, when I was reading this, I thought of immediately as something that we would need to discuss, because I think setting it up for anybody coming into it, it doesn't feel like a contemporary comic, but not, again, not in a bad way.
Right. Yeah. So when I use, I mean, I stand by the word hokey, but right. I don't mean hokey in a negative way. I think that, you know, if you go with the assumption that there are going to be things about this story that are just weird, kind of wacky, mm-hmm. and definitely doesn't figure into the kind of superhero or even fantastical stories that we're used to from the mainstream, and not just DC and Marvel, then I think they're going to come away enjoying this much more. But I'd be curious to talk to someone who, let's say, is not listening to us talk about this right now, and then have them pick this up and get their take on it. Especially yeah. superhero fans.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. It's curious when you say, like, when you ask that question, who the target audience is, because I wonder if if Dark Horse will draw in, you know, Margaret Atwood fans, for example, mm-hmm. who then aren't maybe used to contemporary comics in the first place, for which this may not seem all that odd. Or if they've got a kind of Venn diagram of, you know, Margaret Atwood readers, or at least kind of literary, readers with a kind of literary mindset or interest, and comic readers, and that Venn diagram overlaps to the point where you get Angel Capper's audience. I'm not quite sure, but yeah, I mean, I think that you hit it as far as wondering what someone coming to this comic book without having listened to us might think about it.
Right. And, you know, maybe putting that in the terms of intended reader is not the best way of doing that, because then that suggests that there was something on Atwood's part that we could detect in writing this. Mm-hmm. And there's no way for us to know that unless she actually came out and said something about right. that, for instance, in her intro. But maybe another way of looking at this is something along the lines of an inferred reader, or what some people call a mock reader. And it's kind of like an inferred author, right? So you, mm-hmm. you read something, and from that text, you kind of infer, okay, who is this author? And, mm-hmm. you know, it may or may not be close or otherwise to the actual living author. Same thing with an inferred reader. And so I would guess that if we're talking about an inferred reader, someone who would appreciate this is kind of what we've been describing, someone with some kind of knowledge of older, mm-hmm. Classic superhero, primarily comics, and they're okay with Atwood engaging with these kind of antiquated ways of dealing with a genre that may come across as a little silly or hokey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, when I was thinking about this reader, I was thinking more of, like, from a marketing standpoint, you know, who does Dark Horse expect to be
right.
buying this? But I think your point is also well made there as well.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and this is, you know, I said earlier, I didn't detect any irony here. So it's very different from, you know, some of the stuff that we have talked about in the past, where we've discussed sort of superhero-y kind of comics that take the genre and have fun with it, kind of pointing out the, at times, kind of absurd mechanisms behind the genre. Mm-hmm. And, you know, something like that, I think, it's not the same kind of reader, let's say, that would really appreciate Watchmen, or at least in the same way, right? Because mm-hmm. I think with Watchmen, there is more of a critical look at the genre historically, ironic, much more so than we have here. This is more reverential, Angel Catbird.
Yeah, it's reverential, and it is... it clearly expresses an enjoyment of the conventions that it's playing around with. You know, it's a fun book, and I think it needs to be taken on that level, but also containing this, you know, kind of serious message about about pets and so on.
Yeah. In fact, that's where the seriousness of this story lies, in its message beyond the story itself. Mm-hmm. Is using the story as a way of inserting, let's say, public awareness messages in a way. Mm-hmm. But having a good time doing so.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's interesting that the very first panel we get is Strig is a thought, has a thought balloon in it. And it's Strig saying something missing doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. maybe the thing that's missing is the kind of, you know, critical irony that that a contemporary superhero comic playing with these same conventions might have.
That's funny. I hadn't thought about that very first panel as a way of Atwood being self-referential to what's going on here, but I'd like to think that that may be the case.
Like a mission statement or whatever, I guess, for this book. But, you know, Golden Age superhero comics don't necessarily make a whole lot of sense. You
know? Yeah, exactly.
I mean, the J. Garrick Flash gets his powers from breathing in hard water fumes. What the hell's that? You don't need to know, right? It's just, okay, I accept it. He can run fast, right? So whatever this, formula is that Strig comes up with, you know, we just accept that it works. Right. And that if you spill it on yourself and an animal, you're going to merge with that animal.
Yes. And, you know, we should mention that the art goes a long way of, of underscoring all the stuff that we've been talking about. And I think Johnny Christmas does a great job here. Now, you know, Johnny Christmas has done other comics that we've discussed on the podcast before. He was the illustrator of Sheltered. He also did Pisces. I didn't read that series, but I really liked Sheltered. And I got a sense of how he is so effective working along with whatever the hell Margaret Atwood's doing in terms of her attitude toward Golden Age comics in the character of Murroyd.
Yeah.
Because he just looks so over-the-top repulsive that you just have, almost every time you see him, you have fun. And when he actually does become rat-like, because he is a hybrid on his own, or of his own, then he looks even more repulsive. So it makes sense that someone with a name like Murroyd, which is kind of a harsh sounding name that is not too far from murder, looks like and is associated with rats.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I, after reading this, I find Johnny Christmas an interesting choice, because I think you're right in isolating Dr. Murroyd as one of the strengths of this work. But otherwise, you know, Johnny Christmas's art leans towards the realistic, but just kind of, I don't know, slightly to the, I don't know, iconic, but more realistic than otherwise, and fitting with a contemporary style that we see a lot. Maybe a little bit of Michael Lark I see in his work, or that kind of level of realism. And so Dr. Murroyd does stand out a bit in comparison to the way, say, Strig or Kate are drawn in their human forms.
Yeah. Now, I want to say something. We were talking about possible readers, right, for this. I want to talk a little bit about what happens when we go to the club, the catastrophe, for the first time. And we have a little setup of this earlier when Strig, after his accident, sees Kate, and both of them, not just Strig, they are erotically, is the best way of putting it, drawn to one another. And then we get a little more of that eroticism at the club, the catastrophe. You know, maybe an intended audience, or if not an intended audience, an inferred reader would be furries. Because there's a lot of that going on in the club. And I don't know. I just thought that was curious.
Yeah, well, it definitely, I mean, one of the things that I appreciate about the book is that it it celebrates the doesn't shy away from the kind of sexual element that comes about when two cat people get within, I guess, range of each other's pheromones.
Right. You know, without going as far as, let's say, Omaha, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
But it's there, and it's fun in that way too.
Right.
I mean, I think it doesn't shy away from it.
Mm-hmm. And I don't want to read too much into this, but I think that we could look at some parts of this first issue or this first book, especially the scenes at the catastrophe, as kind of a celebration of hybrid identity.
Right.
Yeah. So, whether that hybrid identity has anything to do with gender identification or ethnicity or what have you, I mean, it's definitely there, and I think it's handled very well.
Yes.
Very lovingly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess one of the other things to mention for potential readers coming into this is that, as we started out with, this is the first book in a series. We don't know how many issue or how many volumes the series is going to have, but it does end in a cliffhanger.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll need to be on board for volume 2, which it says at the end is coming in February of 2017.
Okay. Yeah. And I hope we get to see more of Count Capula, if for no other reason, so I can see the name Count Capula and say it even more.
Yeah, well, the cover or the teaser, I guess, image for volume 2 does have Count Catula on it, and in the background appears to be his Transylvanian castle with the giant cat gate in the front. So, so maybe we'll be getting more of that.
Oh yeah, I'm looking at this now. Yeah, you're right. And also, that character seems to have a lot of comedic potentials as well, because at one point after he goes on a surveillance mission, he comes back and he wants to get a little rest, and so he's at Kat's apartment. She says, well, why don't you just go into my closet and you can sleep there, because, he's part bat. Mm-hmm. So he goes in there and sleeps, and when he comes out, he has one of Kat's brassieres on his head. And they joke about that. So I'm wondering if, as this series unfolds, he's going to come across, not as a comic relief, but as someone who has a comedic side to him.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that gets into a bit the tone of this, because when one hears that there is a character called Count Catula in the book, one might think that he's going to be a villain.
Right.
Right? He's going to be in the Dracula vein, but he's not. He's an ally, as far as we can tell so far. He's an ally, and you're right. There is this kind of comic relief element as well.
Mm-hmm. So, reading this now and seeing the pinup art in the back of this, mm-hmm. something that I found out earlier this year kind of makes sense. At the Dallas Comics Convention, back in, I think it was May, I was there, and Robert Wilson IV, who is from the DFW area, was mm-hmm. there, as he normally is. And when I went up to talk to him at his table, he was working on something, and I asked him what it was, and he mentioned something about this new comic coming out called Angel Catbird that Margaret Atwood is doing. And he said someone at Dark Horse asked him if he would do an illustration, something about this character. So I'm guessing that maybe in the next volume, the book that comes out in February, may see that he has one of the pinup pieces.
That'd be great.
Yeah, it would. So this was a fun read.
Yeah.
So you want to get to the next title that we're discussing this week?
Yeah, and this is Ever After number 1
mm-hmm.
from Vertigo by David Justice, Matt Sturgis, Travis Moore.
Does the art, yeah.
Yeah, and And this is a continuation, basically, of Fables. So we're introduced at the beginning of this issue to the world that we basically left off in with Fables, where most of the Fables had returned to the homeland. Their kind of existence had been exposed to the world, to the mundane world, but there's not a real kind of central organization to the Fables anymore like there was in Fable Town. And so we're seeing just basically the remnants of some Fables who've remained in the mundane world in order to defend it against some of the magical things that are going on now in this world.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sturges is definitely not new to the Fables world. He was the writer of Jack of Fables, and then right. Sturges and Justice both wrote Fables Wolf Among Us. So it's interesting that they did what could be called something like a prequel to Fables, right. and then now they're doing what you could call a sequel mm-hmm. to Fables in Ever After. We do get some characters in here. In fact, you know, most of the characters we've seen before in Fables. I think that it is appropriate that we get Bigby and Snow toward the beginning, but we see them just briefly, right? Because mm-hmm. we find out that they are a couple of the Fables who have decided to live, you know, back in their original world, right? They're not living here in the Mundy world, but they have brought their son Connor to Feathertop to train, and that's where, you know, much of the spy element of, I guess, what will become Ever After comes from, is that Feathertop is, I guess, overseeing this agency, which is housed in Washington, D.C., and we don't get much information about what this agency is all about, but it's very James Bondian, and it's closely aligned with the Fables. And so I guess it is a Fables version of the kind of spy world we get with James Bond. I mean, it plays on some of those tropes, right? The mm-hmm. the toys, the cars. In fact, when Connor goes, well, or after he's dropped off by his parents with Feathertop, he's excited about everything he'll get to play with.
Right.
In fact, one of my favorite parts of this first issue is that in front of Snow and Bigby, Feathertop says, "No, Connor, this is not, you know, a place where you can play around with Ashton Martins." And then as the parents are driving off, he says, "Yeah, there are Ashton Martins, of course."
Yeah. Yeah, so we're kind of introduced to this world through the introduction of Connor into it, but also we also get a mission that's already taking place with a team that's made up of Bo Peep, Peter Piper, and Hansel,
mm-hmm.
Which is, I guess, it was an interesting combination because Hansel, Hansel worked for the adversary, right?
Right.
Back in the day, so now he's on this team, and I don't recall Peter Piper being a character in Fables that appeared all that much.
No, if he, I mean, I can't remember his appearance. You can, so.
Oh, whatever. I don't even know if he did.
Yeah.
I mean, he may have, I mean, not.
But if he did, I mean, it didn't stand out in any way. It wasn't sustained. Now, Bo Peep, yeah, and. You know, I started off by talking about Ever After within the context of Connor and Feathertop, but the story where this actually begins, where this first issue starts, is with Hansel, Bo Peep, and Peter Piper, and they're in the middle of what looks like some kind of zombie apocalypse, right?
Right.
Bo Peep is slashing up these zombies, and this is where things get a little confusing. But I'm okay with that because this is it's going to be an ongoing series. We'll find out more about this. But we don't get much information about what's happening, like where exactly they are and why are there zombies all around. So is this what, like, the Fables meets the Walking Dead? Mm-hmm. There's something going on here. We don't know exactly what's going on with their mission. Although when we get to the very end, and we don't want to spoil anything there, there are a couple things that happen that not completely, but starts to give at least a few more clues about what this mission is and what's happening with the zombie creatures.
Right, right. And they're in, I guess they're in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
For this mission, and a whole bunch of strange things are happening in St. Louis in addition to the zombies.
Yeah.
One of the things one of the senses I'm getting from this book is that it's going to be a much more maybe straightforward adventure series than Fables was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Fables had such a huge cast of characters, and so it allowed for a variety of different types of stories. Whereas it looks like we're going to get kind of one kind of story and probably a much more limited cast of characters. We're going to have the Fables who go out and on the missions, like we see with Bo Peep, Peter Piper, Hansel, and where we see Connor going. And then we're going to have the kind of mission control group that is Feathertop along with Aisha, She Who Must Be Obeyed, and Thomas, who I'm not sure if which Fable Thomas is yet.
Yeah, the redhead guy?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. Yeah, I get the sense that this is going to be something along the lines of Chris Roberson's Cinderella stories for Fables.
Yeah, exactly.
Where you have a more, you know, narrowed or limited cast, and there are more discernible adventures, or at least, you know, more of a cohesive storyline where you don't have a number of things going on at the same time, like in Cutaways, right? Mm-hmm. And that would be cool, because I really enjoyed the Cinderella stories, those mini series.
Yeah, I agree, too. Those were ones I liked a lot. When I first saw the solicit for this series, I was a bit ambivalent about it. I felt like, you know, Fables ended in a decent place. I was fine with it, you know, with it ending there. I could see, you know, the occasional miniseries that returns us to it. I even was, you know, kind of okay with The Wolf Among Us, because it as you said, is a kind of prequel to what we get in Fables, and it was, you know, tied into the video game as well.
Mm-hmm.
I was surprised to see an ongoing series of Fable stories returning. Overall, this is a pretty solid adventure story. I don't know if the series will rise to the level that Fables got to. It still has time to do that, but it is definitely, I think, a different creature than Fables was.
Right. Now, are you suggesting that having read this first issue, you feel better about Ever After than you did when you read the solicit?
Yeah, a bit. You know, I don't know if the series has a compelling reason for existing, you know, but that's not necessary here. As a Vertigo series, it doesn't even feel like a Vertigo series anymore. It feels more like a kind of straight adventure superhero type series. I think part of that too is in Travis Moore's art, which I think is really good and mm-hmm. fits the story very well. It's very dynamic, action packed. He draws humans really well, but he also draws the fantastical elements well too. So it hits everything. It has a good cliffhanger ending. I'm less ambivalent about the book than I was when I first heard about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm really pleased after reading this. I wasn't as, I don't know, ambivalent or suspicious as you were when I saw it solicited. I mean, you know, I love Fables, and so a part of me, when we saw this was solicited a couple of months ago, I thought, oh, great, we're going to mm-hmm. get more Fables. However, there is a side of me that is anti-sequel, especially mm-hmm. once you have a successful and long run of something. I don't know. Part of me just feels, let it rest. As you might imagine, I'm not the biggest fan of, you know, Star Wars going on and on and on, you know, things like that. You know, create new stories. You don't have to keep going back to you know, the prime, the same old well over and over again. So there was a part of me that really worried about this. It's like, why can't we just let Fables rest in peace? I think one of the things that would have me a little more critical of this, or at least not expecting as much, if Bill Willingham had been the writer of this. Because, you know, him setting down the pen, you know, having written Fables right. for so long, it's like, okay, he's finished with it, that's fine. Now, other people can play with his story, his mm-hmm. premise, that's okay. So I'm glad he's not the one to bring this back. But from this first issue, you know, if this is what we have to expect from Sturges and Justice, and, you know, I like the job that they did with Wolf Among Us, then I'm definitely on board for this.
Okay, yeah, good. I'm going to keep checking it out, too, and see where it goes. But I think that Sturges and Justice and more all hit the ground running with this book. It's action-packed while also setting the stage for what the new concept is going to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And with this ending, I know you mentioned that there is a, you know, really interesting cliffhanger here. And we don't want to give away too much information and spoil things, but I am very intrigued in who this little girl is. I know that Hansel refers to her as a witch, and you know, there was quite a collection of witches in Fables. So I'm wondering if this is someone that we have, if not seen, then she's been alluded to before.
Yeah, that I'm curious about that, because that would also go a long way to explain what's going on with the world. Is she a fable,
mm-hmm.
or is she a part of this new phenomenon in which the kind of magic of the fable world is seeping into the Mundy world, and she is a manifestation of that?
Right. And it's also good that Hansel has not lost his religious zealotry. You know, in working with the Fables now.
Right.
Well, let's get to the last title that we're going to be discussing this week, and this is an Image comic, a new series written by Jim Zub with art by Jabril Morissette-Fan, and that is Glitter Bomb.
Yeah, and I want to say just right off the bat that this book really blew me away right out of the gate. I really like this comic, and I didn't really even know what to expect. Especially from the title Glitter Bomb, what this was gonna be, but you know, basically we're following this main character Farrah, who is not old by normal standards, but by Hollywood standards, she seems to be over the hill, and she's an actor. She had been successful at one point in time, and now she's not getting the parts that she's going up for, because they're going to younger women. So she's struggling as a working actress in Hollywood and as a single mother, and then some strange things happen to her.
Right. Actually, we get the strange things at the very beginning of this first issue. And in this way, Zub is playing into kind of a classic formula that we see all the time in comics, and that is beginning with a surprising event. Mm-hmm. And then, after the first narrative beat, back up a bit. You know, like a day before, or, you know, 3 weeks before. Here it is 6 hours earlier. Mm-hmm. This one happened. So basically we get Farrah Durante, our protagonist. She's talking with some kind of Hollywood executive, right? And he, as you might expect, is on the sleazy side. And when he is talking with her at one point, surprisingly, this thing, uh-huh. and the best way of describing it is like a freaky long-ass tongue. juts out of her mouth and pierces his head. Mm. It's like, well, what is going on here? Then we get 6 hours earlier, she's in a waiting room. She's, you know, it's kind of a cattle call.
Right.
And this is where she learns that, you know, she used to be an actress. She's a little over the hill for Hollywood because this younger actor named Brooke comes in and sits beside her. And, of course, Brooke is what you probably call, you know, kind of a superficial actor. She doesn't, have much depth to her. She talks about her trainer, her mm-hmm. acting trainer, her therapist, and this and that, and then makes a disparaging comment about, oh, I recognize you, and it says, you know, you're an older actor.
Mm-hmm.
So, we know not to like her. But then we don't get the freakiness going on with Farrah. You know, what is this weird tongue-like thing emanating mm-hmm. from her face until a little over halfway through this first issue where, you know, she's not feeling too good about herself. And at one point she walks into the water. It seems to kill herself, although she doesn't seem to have the kind of life where she would want to kill herself.
Right.
So that struck me as a little strange, but whatever happens to her, and, you know, we don't know exactly what happened to her yet. Mm-hmm. This is where the strangeness begins, in this water.
Yeah. I would mention, going back to something you said at the beginning of that summary, that the guy she kills at the beginning is her agent.
Oh, that's the agent.
Yeah. Yeah. So and that's important because we get this build up in the issue that her agent has called her
and wants
her to come and see her, and her friend who's babysitting for her, Farrah kind of holds out the promise, I'll introduce you to my agent. So
I guess you can't do that now.
Yeah. So all those little pieces, I mean, I think that's what makes that opening so effective, is that, we know where this first issue is going because we've seen the ending of it already. And so that adds to this sense of foreboding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Having forgotten that was her agent and not just some kind of Hollywood executive does put that in a different perspective. So I'm glad that you pointed that out. I like this first issue. Although when I finished reading it, I wondered, is this the kind of series that I will want to read on a monthly basis, or would I feel more comfortable reading this once it's collected? In other words, waiting for the trade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this may be a good trade series, but I want to support it as well. Now I wonder, when you mention that too, that brings up something else I also wanted to mention about the series, which is that this first issue at least does have some back matter, mm-hmm. Which is an essay by Holly Rachelle Hughes about her experience in Hollywood, and very specifically with sexual harassment and the way women are treated in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And so since Farrah's story is the story also of how women are treated terribly in the Hollywood system, I'm wondering if we're going to get more of that throughout the series as back matter, much in the way that we see in Bitch Planet.
Mm-hmm. Or Ed Brubaker with the crime stuff.
Right. But I'm thinking of Bitch Planet even more because this essay in the back here kind of reinforces the political message, or the social political message, that the series is getting across.
Right. You know, I think for me the difference between Glitter Bomb number one and Bitch Planet was that after the first issue of Bitch Planet, I didn't have many questions about the direction that was going, mm-hmm. politically speaking, and that essay in the back underscored that. And I know that you and I disagreed as to, you know, whether that was heavy-handed or not, but they did work in concert. This one, I mean, I definitely get the essay, and it is an enlightening piece that mm-hmm. Hughes contributes here. I don't know if the series is going in this direction. I guess I'd have to see what the next couple of issues were. Mm-hmm. And if it is going in this direction, really highlighting some of the more abusive sides, especially when it comes to issues of gender, of the entertainment industry, then maybe we would be missing out by waiting for the trade because we wouldn't get these pieces at the end if they're going to continue doing this.
Right, right. And that's where I was going with that in relationship to the trade. Is this going to be something like what Bitch Planet or what Ed Brubaker's stuff does, mm-hmm. and that this will be supplementary matter to the individual issues versus something that we would get in the collections.
Right. Because I would think, okay, reading Glitterbomb without Hughes' story at the end, right? If I didn't read that mm-hmm. story, if it wasn't a part of this first issue, and you would have asked me, is there any potential political agenda going on in Glitterbomb after the, you know, with the first issue? I'd say, I don't know. I have no clue. You could, but then again, you could easily say no, because it could go either way. But maybe this essay is a clue as to where Zub is wanting to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think in reading that essay and then going back and relooking at the book, especially that opening scene, you know, the agent's sexual harassment of Farah is so blatant and so over the top. And, you know, as somebody now, as you know, that I'm, you know, an academic administrator and have had to go through lots of sexual harassment training. Mm-hmm. I just look at that and go, oh my God, this is way over the top. But then what that essay really highlights is that in the entertainment industry, this is normal because there aren't the kind of repercussions there that you could have, you know, in, you know, the academy or in most other workplaces for that matter.
Right.
So these men like this agent can behave this way with relative impunity until they get a giant tentacle stuck through their head. then they probably have a split second of regret.
Right. You know, and maybe we can also find another little clue in the artwork that I don't know if this is what Zub and Morissette Fahn or the editors of this series have chosen to do, but the images of Farah that accompany Hughes's essay, and there are two that we get. There's one on the very first page where we get that image, although it's, you know, not colored, or in full color, of Farah sitting in the waiting room, you know, will she or won't she get called to read a part? And then at the very end of the issue, there's another image of Farah that was used in the story we just read, where she's looking rather down, forlorn. So I'm wondering if the choice of these images showing Farah as a possible victim, showing her as being fragile here, if this is a message that, or maybe a clue as to maybe the linking of the direction this series will take along with the tone of this essay.
Yeah, that's a good question. So I'm curious to see how this essay ties into where this series is going. Are we going to see basically Farah on this kind of extended revenge fantasy through sexual harassment in the Hollywood system, or is there going to be other elements that this series is going, or other issues that this series is going to address as well?
Right. And we should add that the artist here, Jibril Morissette Fahn, I think he's a newcomer, right? Don't they mention this in the back material?
Yeah, and that amazes me.
Mm-hmm.
Because the art in this book is really incredible. That was a big draw for me wanting to come back to this series as well. It reminds me in a lot of ways, not just a bit, of Sean Murphy.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. You're right.
But also in a good way. It's a little bit tighter, I think, than Sean Murphy's art.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some Sean Murphy elements, I think, especially when we get underwater and, you know, you got the wake. Sean Murphy's art on the wake going along with that. But for a first-time artist, it's really well done. The storytelling skills are fabulous. The facial expressions are really great. And this is not an action-packed first issue. So it's basically having to show a lot of conversations. And he does it in a really dynamic way.
Right. Now, I'm looking back at the back matter before Hughes's essay and after the story proper. And Morissette Fond does mention that Glitterbomb is his first major comics project. Yeah. So that there's that. But I'm also looking at what Zub wrote, and he mentions that he suggests that Hughes will have essays in future issues, because he mentions her and says in future issues she'll be focusing on other aspects of production, along with the strange and disturbing situations that happen off camera. But then earlier he had mentioned something about this being a Hollywood horror comic, so it's going to be curious to see how the message of the story, maybe underscored by whatever Hughes is writing, is going to be linking up and melding with the horror aspect.
Yeah.
So there you go. We looked at three new titles. We started off with Margaret Atwood and Johnny Christmas's Angel Catbird. After that, we looked at the first issue of Ever After, written by David Justice and Matthew Sturges, with art by Travis Moore. That's from Vertigo. And then we wrapped up with Jim Zub and Jabril Morissette Fond's Glitterbomb number one from Image.
Yeah, three books that are definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, and also three starting points, since these are the first issues or volumes of their respective titles. And if you want to find great prices on future volumes or issues of this, as well as the current Angel Catbird, you would do well to visit the website of our sponsor, which is Discount Comic Book Service. Go to dcbservice.com, and there you're going to find some unbelievable discounts, just as Andy pointed out at the top of the show. And then after you do get your comics there, get in touch with us and let us know what you're going to be reading. If you go to our website, comicsalternative.com, you'll find that you can leave us a voice message from the comfort of your own computing device or personal tablet, phone, through SpeakPipe, which is really easy to use. Or you can call us the old-fashioned way. Our phone number is 415-3-COMICS. That's 415-326-6427.
That's right. Or you can get a hold of us by email. We are twoguys@comicsalternative.com. Or you can get a hold of us individually. I'm Andy@comicsalternative.com.
And I'm Derek@comicsalternative.com.
And we also have our Twitter feed, which is @2guyswithPhDs.
That's right. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Google+, Goodreads, Pinterest, and YouTube. You can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. You can stream us on Stitcher. You can also find us on TuneIn. You can listen to us on Spotify. If you're an Android user, on Google Play Music. And as we pointed out earlier, now on iHeartRadio. But you know, you can find every single episode of our podcast, as well as the various reviews and the comics-related commentary that we post on our blog, by going to our website, comicsalternative.com.
That's right. All the ways to get a hold of us and let us know how we're doing.
Yes, and we do like to hear from you. So yes. Please get in touch. And then next week, we will have a special episode where Gwen Tarbox and I are going to be talking about this year's Ignatz nominees and winners.
Yep, and you're heading to
SPX.
SPX, so have a good trip.
Yeah, I leave on Friday. I'm looking forward to it. So I'll let you know how that goes.
Yeah, do.
Yeah. Until then, I'm Derek.
And I'm Andy. See ya.